Welcome back to CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. In this episode, I'm speaking with Daniel Jarjura about what it takes to build and scale developer-first startups. Daniel shares his journey from software engineer through founder, advisor, and now managing director at Avolta, where he helps engineering-led companies prepare for exit. We explore the unique challenges of developer-first businesses, from identifying genuine developer needs, leveraging open source for growth, scaling from niche solutions up to enterprise sales, and of course, preparing for a merger or acquisition exit. I'm your host, Adam Horner. As a coach for CTOs from startups to enterprises, I empower tech leaders to escape the cycle of lurching from crisis to crisis and build the skills to lead with confidence, clarity, and purpose. I provide practical, personalized coaching tailored to the challenges faced in the organization, helping each CTO shift from reactive problem solving to proactive strategic leadership. I help each CTO forge their own path for growth, allowing them to delegate confidently, align engineering with the business, and fully step into their role as a trusted, respected peer at the executive table. This podcast enables me to bring some awesome playbooks to you and the many CTOs that are looking to broaden their knowledge base. Between me and my guests, we cover valuable topics for CTOs, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your own playbook so that you can excel as a CTO. Keep listening to learn why sometimes stealing a customer can be much more valuable than you think. Daniel, thank you so much for joining. It's very fun to have you on the podcast, finally.
Thank you, Adam. It's a pleasure.
Now, we've been talking about doing this for a while because not only have you do you run a community that's mostly French people, but actually got quite a bit of CTOs from a lot of different places as well. But you've kind of transitioned as well recently. So tell us a little bit about, you know, stepping away from being a CTO to working with CTOs.
Yes, absolutely. And so my background is a software engineer. So my initial interest was to program computers, but I was always interested to go beyond that. So even in my early career, I didn't just work with developers, but started working in product management, then manage a customer support team. Then I was so frustrated that salespeople were making more money than me on sales I was doing that I ended up taking over the business development department as well, doing some sort of solutions engineering, sales engineering, until I became an entrepreneur. So
you kind of rounded out your skill set just basically through frustration.
Yeah, absolutely. Frustration and curiosity has always been my main driver. And if you add to that the fact that someone would tell me you can't do it, then that would really motivate me to do it. And I remember very vividly when I was in engineering school 20 plus years ago, all of my professors were telling me, you have to work as a developer for 5 to 10 years. You really have to hone your technical skills. And I think that was really great advice. And I said, well, yeah, but I'm interested in product. And when I was in engineering school in 2004, 2005, product management was not really a discipline.
So like, it was a very nascent idea back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. So they said, oh, project management. Yeah, if you work enough as a software engineer, then maybe you work in project management. And I said, no, I want to do it now. So I always like kind of try to put myself in situations, learning jobs and disciplines that I didn't know that I was not trained for. And this is what actually led me to become an entrepreneur. But my initial entrepreneurship idea was to work with software engineers. So that was actually 11 years ago.
Right. So that was kind of what your first idea of actually building something for a developer.
So 12 years ago, I left the company I was working for and I wanted to start a company. And end of 2012, early 2014, that was not a great year to start a startup.
And this was in Paris, I presume.
Yes, that was in Paris.
Not the easiest place to start a company anyway.
Well, it's become way better. But in 12, 13 years ago, that was much more difficult. And especially because at the time, startups were the things that failed in the early 2000s.
The bubble burst.
So it's really crazy to say today, but in the early 2010s, startups failed. most of the startups actually failed and burned millions and millions of dollars and did not succeed because they were way too early for the internet. So I wanted to start a startup, but I didn't have an idea. I didn't have a co-founder. And I was an engineer. And so I didn't want to find someone out of business school to be my CEO. I found that that was an absurd idea. So I said, I want to start a company that helps developers start companies. So I went to see my former engineering school. And I said, do you have an incubator? And they said, no, we don't. And I said, you know what? I'm going to start a company to help engineers from our school and others to start companies. Are you in? And they said, yes.
Oh wow!
And,
okay.
Yeah, and the dean of the school was really, really cool. He was like doing a lot of experiments, and it was crazy enough to say, okay, let's do it. So I started a joint venture with my former engineering school, and the pitch was to start a tech startup accelerator for engineers by engineers.
Right. So very much focused on exactly the people that you were.
Yeah, and especially the idea was to fight the usual setup at the time, which was a CEO out of with an MBA, looking for an engineer to be their CTO. And at the time, in France and across Europe, it was like very probable to have CEOs with 60, 70, 80% of the company and the CTO with 20 or 30%.
Minority partner.
That was like the norm. Yeah. I said, this is bullshit. One, CTOs should be equal partners.
Yeah.
And two, engineers can start companies. And that has been like for the past 12, 13 years of my life, the common thread of what I've been doing is to really work with engineering leaders and saying that it doesn't matter if you are a software engineer, you can start companies, you can lead companies, you can co-found companies, and you don't have to be like the geek in a dark room coding the product while others take all the money and the glory.
So very much giving people the permission, if you like, as well as the incentives to do so.
Exactly. And so I started that in 2013. Right. And at the time, we didn't really have like a business model for startup accelerators. And Europe is not the US. It's still not the US in terms of startup ecosystem. And in 2013, that was definitely not the US. So the only sensible business model that we found at the time was to charge big corporations sponsoring fees just to have access to startups.
Right, so a corporate venture capital kind of approach.
It was not invested in startups, actually. So we were charging them for the right of talking to startups.
Okay, so literally just access.
Yeah, just access. Wow. And at the time, there were very, very few corporate venture firms. And even traditional VCs would seldom raise from enterprises. So they would like very, very seldom have corporations as LPs. Yeah. So for the big corporations, especially the big French corporations, this startup thing was so new. They're like, okay, yeah, I'll pay you $100K to meet them.
Right.
So that was the business model. And for the startups, it was completely free. And we didn't take equity because I didn't think it was fair to take equity without investing.
Right.
And we would help the companies raise their first round of funding. So in hindsight,
so you help them with traction and connections.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, okay. In hindsight, that was really stupid not taking equity because a lot of them became very successful. But I mean, I wouldn't take equity without investment. That would have been dumb. And I think that a lot of the smart founders that we worked with wouldn't have gone through the accelerator if we were taking equity.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few that take equity for very little additional help, but that tends to be once the accelerator's created a significant name for it, like EF or YC, for example.
Yeah, and EF pays the founders, by the way.
Yeah.
So and we didn't have enough runway to do that, so we just said, we'll help you for free, and hopefully we'll make enough like communication that we will get more customers, and at some point we'll raise a fund.
So it's a unique business model that worked.
Yes, and it worked, but eventually I was not able to raise a fund. The school that was my partner did not want to, so I sold my shares. The structure was reintegrated within the school, and I started another company, which did not work. I did that for 3 years, and after I closed my second company, that was 2019, I really wanted to start a software company. So the company I started before was a platform. So I was connecting entrepreneurs with big corporations, which were like the two networks I already had.
Yeah.
And so the big corporations, my goal was to sell a platform to big corporations so they can select entrepreneurs to come and pitch and train and consult and advise, etc. But eventually I transformed into a training company, and that was not really my goal. And training, especially on very different topics, is a very bad business model. So I decided to stop the company. But I really like building our internal software to help with all the complexities of managing physical training and consulting, and having to manage freelancers that you have to pay and the invoices, etc. So, and all the administrative nightmare that went with it. So I want to build a training software, so a learning management system for developers, because this is like the people I know. So I started calling all the CTOs I knew, saying, hey, I'm building this learning management system to train developers with integrated IDE and autocorrect, etc. So you can train them on new frameworks and new languages. And they said, no, this is the most stupid idea I ever heard. Because when I hire my developers for a lot of money, the last thing I want them to do is to learn something else. I want them to code, and build my product.
Sounds about right.
But, yeah, but the only thing I'm struggling with is to scale my team. Like, the more developers I have in my team, the more I struggle. And the worst is when developers become managers. And this is where I really need training. Do you know anyone who could do that? And this is how, very opportunistically, I started developing coaching and training and advisory services for CTOs and developers that want to become better leaders and managers. Something you don't know anything about, Adam.
Story of my life, yeah.
Exactly. And I did that from 2019 to the end of 2023, so for 4 years.
Yeah.
A lot of that during COVID, and which was a great activity to have during lockdown. Especially in 2020, 2021, startups were raising funding like crazy. And very smart developers would end up having to manage from one day to the other 13, 20, 30, 40 developers. And they had no clue how to do that. So that was really fun to do. And it was fun because I had to learn about very different industries and very different verticals, but still working with CTOs hand in hand.
Yeah.
And
and this was sort of during the Zoom boom, wasn't it?
Effectively, yes, exactly.
During lockdown.
So yeah. I was working from home with a newborn. My wife is also a business owner. So we were both working from home, taking care of our kids, taking turns. Don't do that, by the way. I'm glad I did.
It's a high pressure environment, that.
Yes, exactly. I'm glad I did that. I can't do it again. And working with CTOs from all over the world on Zoom. Creating videos and training material and working actually more and more with VC firms that would use me as an external operating partner as soon as they invested in a company, saying, hey, I think the CTO really need your help. Go spend some time with them. So I did that a lot. Then I started getting called by founders directly before they would raise funding to restructure an organization or to do due diligence. Then started doing a lot
of team due diligence type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And started doing a lot of due diligence for M&A transactions. So very naturally, I got connected with investment bankers and VC firms and PE firms. And at the time, I really wanted to stop working alone because that had been 4 years. And I realized that I was too young to do that until the rest of my life. So I wanted to be part of a team again. And I really knew well the founders of Adolta, which is a tech M&A boutique out of Paris. So I called them, say, hey, do you think we could work together? And say, yeah, welcome.
And that's the end of where you are now.
Exactly. If I had applied, I don't think I would have gotten an interview. But because I knew the founders.
Because you're inside there already, yeah.
Yeah. So they said, okay, we would be very happy to have you. So I joined as a partner last year to advise, engineering-funded software companies on M&A and growth fundraising. So I'm still talking to the same people. So software engineers starting companies in industries like cloud, infrastructure, DevOps, DevTools, open source, and cybersecurity. But I really like focus on companies that are funded and that are led by engineers. And we advise them on M&A transactions and fundraising. We really focus on small caps. So that's company with an enterprise value between 20 to 200 million euros. And the idea is really to help them either connect with a strategic acquirer that would like acquire the product, the team, and some of the clients, or to start getting funding from investors that they don't have access to.
Okay, so he's expanding the cap table, basically. Yeah, excellent. And so, I mean, I know that in both M&A and VC world, there isn't sort of a typical day. There isn't really a typical week. But in terms of the kinds of companies you're working with, I mean, you mentioned there that you're working small cap. But is there sort of a lower bound? Are you sort of looking at anybody who's sort of just sort of two or three people in a room still, or do you wait until they've got to a certain stage before it becomes interesting for Avolta?
Yeah, it's first of all, our cost structure makes it uninteresting for them to work with us when there are just a few people in the room. So usually the types of company that would require our services already make a few millions in ARR.
Right.
They're not necessarily EBITDA positive, even though it would help. And I have a few things to talk about that. And that's when that's the best time for them to work with an advisor like ourselves. And also about small cap, something that it's interesting to keep in mind is that in Europe, the majority of exits are under 50 million euros of enterprise value. So most of the market is actually in small cap for tech startups.
Yeah, the highest volume, isn't it? So you end up working with quite a lot of companies on a week-by-week basis, and I imagine.
Yes. So that's actually the fun thing about this job is that in the same day, I'm going to be looking at AI company, then a cybersecurity company, then a company that is improving CI/CD pipelines, and et cetera, et cetera. So in terms of cognitive load and change, that's really, really up to the roof. But that's really what I was looking for. So that's part of the job that I really, really like is that I have in a few days, I need to really absorb a huge amount of information about the company. And because I work in small cap, so usually companies get acquired for their product, not for their financials. So there is a limited amount of financial engineering that we do around those companies, but there is a lot of strategic positioning and talking with CPOs from big companies to really find a fit between a product that they need to keep growing and the startups that we have in our portfolio.
Right, so sort of pattern matching gaps to startups a lot of the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And in terms of what those sort of typical companies are looking for, you've sort of covered that they're sort of for developers by developers, but what are sort of the typical developer needs that you see that people start looking for in order to sort of start these companies in the first place? Because the rationale that a lot of people come up with, well, you know, I just needed to scratch my own itch, effectively. I need to solve my own problem. And that's where often the initial idea comes from. But I imagine by the time they get to the stage where they're talking to you, they've probably pivoted and evolved quite a bit from there. So what are sort of the typical developer needs you see these companies tackling?
So it's interesting because a lot of the advice you would find online about starting a company is always around, find something, a problem that you want to solve for yourself and then it will magically happen. And when it comes to developers, when they do that, most of the times they build features and
rather
features, yeah, other than products.
Yeah.
They built a product, but on a very, very narrow niche. And that's good because I think we should start by product. I mean, I met with MBAs that were starting with TAM, total addressable market. So they were doing all those studies about total addressable markets and we need to go these because this is where you have a lot of market, et cetera. And that's really bullshit because when you hear about stories about like the top tech companies today, 100% of the time, the total addressable market that was in their early decks is lower than their own market cap today.
Right.
Not accounting for the whole market. So total addressable market is bullshit, but you need to have a sense of how big a market is to really get into a startup. Otherwise, it's just a small product that you build for you. Hopefully you can open source it, make it available for the community, and great. But there is a very big difference between scratching your own itch, as you said, and building a product that would sell several hundreds or thousands of people, and building a product with a vision to build a company. Now, there is a small thing to keep in mind, is that whether you want to build a VC-compatible company or not.
Because it's quite a difference, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. VCs, especially tier one VCs, they're in the game of investing in potential billion-dollar companies. So what they want to hear is a story of how you can become the next Datadog, or the next Neo4j, or the next GitLab. So this is what giving you examples of developer-first companies.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of stories that they want to hear. And they will every day prefer to lose millions on a potential billion-dollar company than to make a 2x or 3x on their investment. They don't care about that. But not all businesses have to be VC-compatible.
Very few businesses are VC-compatible, really.
And most businesses are not VC-compatible. And
yeah,
you can make a very comfortable living, building a company that is doing a few millions of ARR per year. And if you're smart enough to be cost savvy and manage to get 10 or 20% EBITDA on your revenue, and you manage to grow 10, 15, 20% per year, then you're a millionaire. And you own 80, 20, 90% or 100% of your company. And all
depending on
well
how much investment you took to get there.
And maybe you didn't take any investment. Especially today, the entry cost for starting a software company is so low that the only investment you would need is really a part if you're training large language models on GPUs. But apart from that, you can really do it on your own with public cloud and available tools without external funding. The only time when you would need external funding is to scale sales.
Yes,
but very few companies actually reach that point.
Yeah, I mean where they need to sort of either outsource it or upscale it themselves in order to get to the point of super high growth.
Exactly. So to go back to your question, if I were to start a developer-first company today, what I would do is look at my own problems. But then before starting building something, I would verify that a lot of people have that problem.
Right. So the scale of the market.
Exactly. So start talking to other CTOs that you know, other developers that you know. One thing that that you could do is to look for alternatives. And you do a Google search. You type the name of the alternative and cite reddit.com, and you look at what or Stack Overflow, and you look at what people are saying about that specific alternative. And if you see hundreds of developer comments about how shitty this product is, you know you're onto something.
Yep.
And often, what I've seen is that developers, because we're trained to not to copy, to build something new,
yep,
It's very counterintuitive for a developer to say, you know what, I'm going to build this one, this software, but better. They're always like, okay, there is no alternatives, I'm onto something. No. If there is no alternatives, you're most probably on the wrong path.
Right, because there's very little demand then in that scenario.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Right. Except if you're working on like very research-oriented work. Like you're imagine that you were working on Transformers seven, eight right. years ago. Of course, there is no alternative because ChatGPT was not invented yet. So this is like the very rare cases where it's okay not to have alternatives. But most of the times...
But in that case, you also need to be questioning your timing as well.
Yes,
because if you've got something that's going to be needed in the future, you often don't know when it's going to be needed and you could start investing way before it's going to be relevant.
Exactly. And I know a lot of AI companies that closed down 2 or 3 years before ChatGPT went out.
Yeah.
Because they were too early.
Yes.
And they're like, oh, they saw the Transformers paper. They're like, oh, this is shit. And they started, they continue working on neural nets or whatever they were working on.
Yeah.
And they missed the Transformer revolution. So, and being in those cases, companies are often too early. So if you want to start a developer first company, look at existing alternatives. Identify those that are really shitty or legacy or with an absurd pricing. And do it better.
Yeah, the absurd pricing is a very good open window. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably a lot of people who will look at some of the existing established software-focused or developer-focused tools and products out there. And some of them have some really, legacy pricing in them. And by legacy, I mean just expensive and unattractive. It's a good place to start.
It's the best place to start. And VCs actually are doing that more and more. So there's this new funding trend, which is called inception funding.
Okay.
So inception is a term that encompasses pre-seed and seed, and usually refers to companies raising funding without a product, but with exceptional founders and a bold idea.
And how bold does bold have to be in that scenario? Because that sounds exciting to me.
So bold is, I'm going to build a product. Bold is usually enterprise focused,
right?
And I'm going to talk about that because there is a big shift happening in the market between product led and sales led.
Yeah.
But usually targeting enterprises, having the ability to go very quickly to $100 million in ARR, and identifying like big. Large enterprises, IT budgets to go and get it instead of Microsoft, Oracle, SAP, or even worse, Accenture, Capgemini, and all the other service integrators.
Yeah.
And what I'm seeing is that more and more VC firms actually try to headhunt former founders or top talents that are working as employees at tech companies to say, hey, do you want to start a company? Because we have identified this areas where we think it would be great to have a company. And we know that you would be a great fit for that. So here's $5 million.
It's almost like the opposite of an accelerator, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically that then, in terms of that relevance to developer-focused companies, is that something that's quite unique to the developer-first ecosystem, or is it something that's happening across the board?
No, it's happening across the board.
Right.
But a lot of the funding right now is being channeled to picks and shovels.
Right, so, the tools to build the good stuff.
Exactly, the tools to build the good stuff. And before we used to call it digital transformation, but now with the AI gold rush, enterprises are literally opening the fire hose of billions of dollars to build AI infrastructure. And to build an AI infrastructure, you need the developer first bricks to make it happen. So you need the data bricks to build your data lake and gather all your data. You need the CrowdStrike and the Palo Alto Networks to secure it You need the Datadog to monitor it. You need, so you need all those layers of developer-first products to build all this infrastructure.
Yeah, and also the data storage and data cleansing and data management stuff that goes around that to hold it all together as well.
Exactly. And so that's why VC funding has become more and more important into developer-first companies. And by developer-first, I don't mean necessarily developer-led. So some companies, like, they only sell to developers. And they have, it's almost like a B2C model where they sell subscriptions. But very, very, very few companies actually manage to have a sustainable business like that. Most developer-first companies, they build B2B products sold to CTOs, but with a great developer experience.
Right, okay. So it's developer-first in that they're the primary user,
yes,
but they're not the customer, they're not the paying entity at the end of it.
Exactly, because very, very few companies actually manage to live off developers, individual developers only.
Yeah.
Especially because developers, as a community, we tend to be very spoiled in terms of free stuff. So you have a lot of open source tools and libraries and products. Every single company is offering free tiers to help you start building without paying anything. So if you want to make money selling to developers, you have to really wake up early to find like the one thing that they want to pay for.
Right. And I think, as you've just mentioned, exactly one of the questions I had there, which was open source is a significant challenge in terms of the business model to those things. Because as you say, that kind of spoils developers in terms of the choice that they have, in terms of tools they have access to, but also in many cases, in terms of that sort of top tier of experience and usability as well. Because the quality of open source software, from the point of view of the end user, whether enterprise or, you know, individual, has really jumped over the last 10 to 15 years too. So how do companies make sure that they can compete with the open source, the free offers, the freemium business models? Is it a case of join them to beat them, or is there some magic to it?
So in order, one, I think open source software has tremendously evolved over the past 20 years. I remember when I was in studying engineering, and even before that, when I started coding, open source was mainly about free software. And so I'm not like a big open source expert, but my understanding is that the early pioneers of open source were really philosophically convinced that software had to be free.
Yeah.
And it was almost like a political act for them to distribute freely their software. And most of these open source developers were not only not interested in starting in companies, but for them, starting a company would be the end of their project.
Yeah, it's like the antithesis of what they stood for.
Exactly. But you had, after that, you started having new generations of developers that started considering open source differently. Now, everyone knows that the world runs on open source. Damn, even Microsoft has embraced open source. Who would have thought? There is no, open source is not a political act anymore. It's not a philosophical mindset. It's just a way to be transparent and to distribute software and to gather a community. Now, because there is a new generation of open source developers, those open source developers also consider starting companies on top of open source projects differently.
And they think about the community as sort of the pool in which they then begin to sell to. Yeah,
exactly. And also the type of business model that they're thinking. So before, you had open source software with no monetization. Then you had open source software, and the way we're going to monetize it, we're going to sell services like trainings and certifications. So that's Red Hat.
Yep.
And then the third wave of open source is now open core. So an open source core product that is available for anyone to use freely if they want. They have access to most of the code source, and they can they can run it if they want. But if you're working for an ambitious company and you want to go fast and you don't want to spend time installing and setting up and et cetera, so you just buy the enterprise version for $99 per month, and we get you set up.
And so it's sort of the done for you cloud or hosted cloud version becomes the commercialized version of it, but the core engine is there and available.
Exactly. And this model actually works really well. GitLab uses that model, for example, and a lot of like even MongoDB uses that model as well. And I'm talking about publicly listed companies. We're not talking about like VC, but these are publicly listed companies with the whole market to comment and vote with their money on what they're doing. And what Mr. Market is saying is that those companies are worth around 10x their revenue. So who would have thought 20 years ago that an open source company would be trading on publicly listed markets for 20x their revenue? Like an open source company making revenue? Well, that was already wild in terms of thinking. So open source nowadays is really a way for developer-first companies to get traction, to build a community while showing transparency and even like security concerns. Like if you're concerned about security, just look at the code source. So you would see that.
Yeah, there's no worries about escrow or anything like that when you come to doing a transaction based on an open source code base. And so does that therefore have an impact on the M&A action on those companies where the community has a value, the services or the products that are built on top of the open source core have a value as well as, for example, the set of people who are working on it?
It's a great question. I haven't seen yet in valuations for M&A community points being taken into the equation.
Right.
But I know that for funding, VCs are now more and more interested in GitHub SARs.
Right.
And a number of commits and the number of people that actually commit to the projects, et cetera, et cetera.
So it's sort of the social currency of developers in that case. Yep.
Exactly. So I've seen several fundraising transactions where
that's been quoted as part of the value.
Yeah, monetization was quite low, but they say, hey, look at our GitHub star curve and look at how many contributors we are and we have and look at how many users we have. And don't worry, we'll find a way to monetize it. If Docker did it, we can.
Right. Okay. Awesome. So there is this sort of idea of There is value there, and it's a leading indicator as to where the financial value will come down the line then.
Exactly. But this also can be explained with the changing nature of VCs. So you have more and more former entrepreneurs and more software engineers going into VC that understand those products, that understand those communities, and that feel more comfortable investing in developer-first or even open source, commercial open source companies because they understand them. So I'm not saying that it's like the norm, but we've definitely seen a lot of improvement in terms of funding being channeled through these companies.
Still, that requires a level of understanding for those people who have come out of industry and into the VC world to be able to convince the investment committee and so on. So it's very tangible. It isn't just ephemeral.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And in talking about sort of, you know, leading indicators and early indicators, scaling revenue for developers is something that's also a challenge. Like when it comes to the classic environment, it's a case of, right, we've got product market fit, either pile money into the marketing or bring in all the salespeople and then just basically go sell more of it. But when it comes to developers, there's this very much sort of connection element that comes to it as well. So how do you typically see that the most successful developer-first companies tackling scaling?
So over the past 5 years, the most common go-to-market for developer-first companies was developer-led.
Yep.
So let's put our product out there. We'll have a free tier so developers can start playing with it. And then when we see that there are several developers from one company that use our product, then we're going to call the CTO and say, hey, John, Michael, and Anna are using our product in your team. And maybe it's time for you to think about an enterprise version. And, you know, I remember hearing an interview of Olivier Pomel, the CEO of Datadog, who was saying we were product-led, not because of we thought that was the best way. We were product-led because we didn't have enough money to hire the best salespeople. But now if you look at Datadog quarterly earnings and how they communicate on revenue growth, it's all about how many million-dollar customers they can sign. Because if you really want to become a big company, you have to sell to big companies. Yeah. So that's why the main go-to-market was, I'm going to target individual developers. If they like my product, they will be tremendous evangelists, which is true. So, you know, I've taught to developers as a teacher. I've sold to developers. I've hired developers. And developers are a tough crowd. So, and you know what I mean. So they can be really, really argumentative. They are fact-based. So when I was doing...
Evidence-based.
Evidence-based. So yeah. When I was teaching, I always started my class saying, hey, you all have a bullshit card. So every time you hear something I said that sounds like bullshit, you yell bullshit, I will stop. And then reconsider my argument. No one ever used it. But it was very comfortable for them to know they had it. And when you sell to developers, you cannot just get any salesperson come and say, oh, we have the best product or blah, blah, blah. And developers like, no, I want to try. I even saw on a forum the other day, a CTO said, oh, there is no sign-in button so I can try on my own. I don't like this product.
Right. It's skeptical by default, isn't it?
Yeah. So I want to touch it. I want to try it first. If it's shit, I'm going to write you a detailed email explaining very specifically why it's shitty. But that has tremendous value. And you get the perfect stranger sending you an essay. An essay they took 3 hours to write about your product they will not use, but they wanted to give you the feedback. So this is how developers are. So you have to be wired this way to really sell well to developers. But then they're not enough. That's why I've seen a lot of companies started by developers scale to a few millions in ARR.
Yep.
But then get stuck. They get stuck because they were not able to move to the next stage. And the next stage is enterprises. And now instead of having to sell to a few developers left and right and then calling the CTO, now they have to go through purchasing and discussing with the CIO of a large bank that has the country manager of Microsoft and Oracle and SAP calling him every day and inviting him to football games and expensive lunches. Not talking about all the service integrators that are invoicing millions to that company every year. And now you tell me, startup, you want to go and sell to those people? So it's a very different ballgame. And that's how a lot of companies get stuck at around 5 million ARR is because they're not able to move to the next stage, which is enterprise sales.
Right. So being, and that almost involves a cultural transformation as you grow through that stage so that you begin to actually talk about the benefits and value of your product in a completely different way.
Totally. And you also have to change the way you sell, because while the CTO of 200 people scale up is still very technical.
Yeah.
And will be comfortable having a technical discussion and asking technical question, the CIO of a 5,000 people organization is rarely technical. They understand the big concepts of tech, usually they're former engineers, but they're mainly executives that want to...
Business first leaders.
Exactly. They're business first leaders. So you have to change the way you sell to understand those people's concerns, because those people are concerned about putting their dollars in the right bets so that they don't get politically bombarded for taking the wrong bets. So
they're fired, essentially.
Yeah, or fired. So I remember having a discussion with a newly appointed CIO of a private bank in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, oh, the first thing I did was outsource everything to a service integrator. And I said, but you know, this is like so 2000 move. And now all the banks actually are reintegrating IT and they're hiring developers and they're doing software in-house. He said, maybe, but no one will fire me for choosing Accenture.
That's the new version of nobody fired me for firing IBM, which was sort of 20 years ago, wasn't it? Yeah,
exactly. So a lot of these big corporations, they're doing safe bets.
So figuring out how to sell to that kind of character is kind of that key stage of scaling up to that, isn't it?
Exactly. And the way to do that in Europe is very different than the US. So in Europe, service integrators like Accenture and Capgemini and all the others, they are essentially the ones deciding where the budget goes because they're the one running IT for enterprises. While in the US, you still have like executives that are running IT. And then for each project, they're going to hire an outsourcing company or service integrator to do it project by project.
Right. But so it's a piecemeal approach.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So the go-to-market in the US is you target the CIO. They're like, oh, this is interesting. Let's do a proof of concept. They do a proof of concept. They say, okay, we'll use this and this integrator, but you can use anyone you want. I don't care. And they do the proof of concept and then they start experimenting. And if you're better than the other guy, then they're going to fire the other guy in an instant because it's all about having the best possible solution.
Yeah. So project competition for that.
Yeah. Europe is a very conservative market. So usually they would prefer bad incumbents to better new players. Yeah. So it's harder to win contracts in Europe. And the best way to do it is through service integrators.
If you're a developer for a startup in Europe, you need to be selling to those big five integrators effectively. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And with a compelling business model for them, which is...
Yeah.
Using your product, they will sell more people.
Yeah.
And this is how you can actually scale in Europe. But most developer-first companies I know make 50% or more of their revenue in the US. Even if the whole team is in Europe, but they still sell to the US because it's an easier market to get your first deals.
Yeah, it's a more liquid market, isn't it? Okay, cool. Let's shift gears a little bit then, because I think when you build a developer-first company, one of the things that you ultimately get to is how do you exit from the market? And often that looks like your area of expertise, which is the M&A deal. So, I mean, what is it that sets you up and plans, you know, gives you a good plan to head towards an M&A exit?
Mm.
Or if it's easier, what are the things that kind of preclude that or stop it from happening?
Yeah. So, obviously, when you start a company, you often don't start it to sell it. But it's important to have it in mind, especially when you know that most companies will hit a glass ceiling. Unfortunately, what I've seen is that companies that start thinking about exit usually do it too late. So in my case, what we would get is a phone call from either a founder or most of the times a VC directly contacting us saying, hey, so we've invested in this company 8 years ago. We want to get out. We need to sell. And I'm like, great. Have you received an LOI from a big company? No. So who?
That's a letter of intent, right?
Yeah, a letter of intent. Thanks for that. Have they been talking to like the top big companies in their sector? No. So we're going to have some work to do. Because what happens is that this company, they're going to say, oh, so you're a banker. Obviously, you know all the strategic acquirers. So we're going to do a roadshow. You're going to present our company to everyone and they're going to fight to buy us. No.
It's like any other market. If they've never heard of you, never worked with you before, there's no relationship to basically. Yeah, okay, right.
Especially in small caps. So if you're a $100 million plus company and you've always, you're already on their radar, and most probably you're EBITDA positive though. So a lot of the private equity funds, they already know you, they already approached you. So this is a proper roadshow. But if you're a company making 5 to 30, 40 million in ARR, the probability of the right acquirer to have heard of you is usually zero. So the right M&A process actually takes around 18 to 24 months to really prepare your exit. The first thing you have to do is to make a list of the 10, 15 companies that are that have the probability, the biggest probability of acquiring you.
Yep.
Two, don't necessarily contact them directly. Go hard on their clients.
Okay. Right.
Steal clients. Because the best way to get noticed by a big company is through their salespeople crying because, oh, we're getting unfair competition from a startup. This is unacceptable. We need to do something about it. And usually when something like that happens, you have two options. Either these big companies start offering your product for free. So their version of your product for free as part of a bigger offering. But yeah. Most of the time, they contact you and say, hey, are you for sale? So this is really, really what you have to do. So you need to get noticed by these companies.
Yeah.
When
but it's you very start similar having... to the early sales pipeline you take in any organization. Yes. Figure out who you're going to sell to and then get in touch with them or get their attention in some way, in this case, by stealing their customers, and make a noise.
Yeah. If you can talk at conferences, be on the same panels as them, so they need to know about you and you need to steal clients or you need to have, so another version of that is to target companies that have the same customers, but a different product.
So that's a complementary product set then.
Yeah, exactly. And that, but again, it's their customer saying, hey, so are you integrating with Startup X? We've never heard of them. And then the chief product officer is like, oh, it's the third time we hear about this startup. We really need to know these guys because we need to, it's the first time that a client asks us to integrate with them. So we might have to buy them.
Yeah.
And one thing that startups don't realize is that a lot of the product executives at big companies, they are very eager to do M&A.
Yeah. They often have a good budget for it, don't they?
So they don't necessarily have a budget because this is very opportunistic, but they usually have a budget to build their roadmap. And their main struggle, especially now, is resources. So when I talk to chief product officers of big tech companies, they and heads of products, they all tell me the same thing. I have more items on my roadmap than resources, and I can't hire more people, either because I'm on hiring freeze, and a lot of tech companies are still on hiring freeze, or because I can't hire them because they're being hired by other people and they're being poached. Yeah, they're being poached. So a VP at big tech company, one of the Magnificent Seven, told me my hiring business partner is the head of M&A.
So basically acquire to hire then.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And that's a great way to is the acqui-hire still quite a good way of creating an exit, or do you create the acqui-hire situation by being a product that is, you know, in a competing space or in a complementary space?
The acqui-hire is usually low valuation. So right. Except if like your ex OpenAI or ex DeepMind or ex researchers at like a prominent AI lab. So
0.1% again.
Yeah. But most companies that get acqui-hired are going to have shitty valuations. So the best way to maximize your valuation is to have commercial traction beyond 10 million.
Yeah.
Like if you have, you do 20, 50% growth, you pass 10 million ARR, this is where you're going to get the best possible valuation. We're talking like north of 100 million in valuation. But very few companies actually get there. So, yeah. And if you are just a product, then you become yet another product that could be acquired, and the case for acquisition becomes harder. It doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. Actually, a lot of those transactions happen, but you're competing with your 10 other competitors that are at the same stage, but one is from Brazil, one is from South Africa, the other one is from India, and there is another one in Czech Republic, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, cool.
So that's where really, if you think about exit, you have to prepare it a long time in advance.
Yeah, 18 to 24 months, as you said before.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, what I love to do is to always take this, Daniel, and try and boil down this excellent conversation into a playbook of sorts. So I think when it comes to developer first platforms and products, then you, I mean, let me see if I get this right. So we identified a genuine developer need, which you described as something where it's not too niche. It's not just scratching your own back. It is something that is quite applicable to developers in general, that you build with developers for developers. So it isn't really a business thing, even though it may be an enterprise buying it, acquiring it. Developers first is the approach to take. We then said that you can often use open source as a growth lever. So whether that is open source core plus services or open source core with an enterprise or cloud service offering on the top of it, both work well as a sort of an accelerator for growth. In terms of raising funding, you mentioned making sure you got good metrics in place, which is kind of core for almost all companies, but some of the metrics that aren't applicable to other organizations do work. So the GitHub stars, the social proof from developers can be useful as an indicator of what's likely to come in terms of revenue in the future. We also mentioned in terms of going to market, ensuring that you sell to the enterprise, and there's that sort of golden step up, as you mentioned, from selling to teams to actually selling to the entire enterprise. So make sure that you see that cliff coming and prepare to go up that step from selling to teams to selling to the enterprise. And then in terms of exit, don't leave it too late was the core message there. 18 to 24 months preparation to create an exit. And then you can actually work your way towards a very solid exit outcome if you do that, by the sounds of it. Did I miss anything out?
No, that was great. You really summarized well what I said.
Brilliant. I love it when I do that. If you were to give one tip then to a CTO who's either in the process of building or is thinking of building a developer-first product startup, what would be the one thing that you'd say that stands out above all the others?
Can I say two things?
Of course.
Yeah. So the first one is like the genesis of everything I've done over the past 12, 13 years is don't wait for an MBA to start a company. That's like the first thing is you want to start a company, just start a company, and you don't have to be the CTO. It's not because you've been a CTO before that you can't be a CEO. And a lot of the great tech companies were started and are being still led by people that had a big technical background.
That's amazing. And a lot of people I know who've started startups or started early stage companies and they don't have an MBA like me have all described it in a similar way where it is like a mini MBA to actually build and run a company in the first place anyway. So
exactly. And the second advice I would give is, so it's a reference to, I don't know if you've heard of Naval Ravikant. So Naval Ravikant is the founder of AngelList, which is a platform to do angel investment in Silicon Valley, and has evolved into a Twitter guru sharing advice about starting companies. And one of his very most famous threads on Twitter, now X, is about how to get rich. And one of the tweets was, learn to build, learn to sell, you will be unstoppable. And when you're a CTO, you know how to build, but often you don't necessarily know how to sell. So the second advice is learn how to sell and sell large, expensive deals, because if you know how to build and you know how to sell, then you will be unstoppable. And that's very true.
That's an awesome piece of advice. I think that goes pretty much for all developers and tech people everywhere. Learn how to sell, because it's valuable across the entire spectrum.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. Daniel, it's been fantastic speaking to you. If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
LinkedIn is the best way. You just get connected to me, and I try very much to answer to everyone. So LinkedIn is the best way.
Excellent. We can put a link to your LinkedIn on there as well. And because you also run a community, the Unicorn CTO as well, which is sort of a quite active Slack community. How do people get access to join that one?
So there's a link on the Unicorn CTO website. You can also ping me and I'll send you a link to join the Slack. That's all it takes.
Excellent. Brilliant. I know that there's, from personal experience, because I'm a member in there as well, there's quite a lot of focus on Paris and France, but there's people from all over the world in that community. It's a fun and vibrant community. Awesome. Daniel, thanks very much for taking time to talk to us and to the listeners today.
Thank you.
It's been a wonderful playbook.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Adam.
Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.